Andrea Mays, Julia Pierpont, and Nuala O'Connor. These are the three super talented and diverse authors we're featuring on tonight's Literary New England radio show. I'm Cindy Wolf Boynton, and I hope you'll stay with me for the next hour. One of the things you'll hear when I talk with Julia Pierpont about her month-old novel, Among the 10,000 Things, is where she came up with the story and what she hoped it might accomplish.
Infidelity and adultery were really the lens through which I ended up exploring these ideas of betrayal and dysfunction within a family.
One of the things Miss Emily author Nuala O'Connor hopes is that her take on Emily Dickinson will help readers see the famous poet in not just a different light, but maybe even a practical one.
Every time I pick up her collected poems, I seem to find something new. She has her poems are often wonderfully aphoristic, and so we can find really helpful gems of truth in them that might help us in our lives. And I think that's what's beautiful about her poetry. She was very astute on human nature and on how we view things, and she can help, you know, Emily can help.
My first guest tonight, Andrea Mays, is the author of a nonfiction title that, since its hardcover release earlier this year, has been on pretty much every bestseller list there is.
Jeffrey Deaver, who is a thriller writer, told me it's a page-turner, it's written like a detective story. So I think it's a combination of things. One is that it's not a book for eggheads. It's actually, you know, for the popular reader of nonfiction. And the other is that the story is informative and exciting. So I think all of that combined is what people have liked.
Andrea is talking about her thick and wonderful The Millionaire and the Bard, Henry Folger's obsessive hunt for Shakespeare's first folio. It's the true, miraculous, and romantic story of the making of William Shakespeare's first folio and of the American industrialist whose pursuit of the book became a lifelong obsession.
Well, it is the story of the apotheosis of Shakespeare from near obscurity shortly after he died until he became the secular god of English language literature. And also the story of a Gilded Age collector in the United States who wanted to own every copy of the first folio, which was the book that saved half of Shakespeare's plays from extinction.
So this is Henry Clay Folger.
Right, Folger, Henry Folger, who was
Folger, he was a
Brooklyn born man born into modest means, went to Amherst College, and when he graduated, he went to work for his best friend's father's oil company, and Folger had the great fortune of having that company taken over by Standard Oil Company of New York, and his new mentor was John D. Rockefeller. So, yes, that is Henry Folger.
Huh. So, I've known about the Folger Library, right, down in Washington,
right,
D.C., but it's interesting. You know what? I always just assumed that the library was named after a man who gave a lot of money rather than someone who actually had a quest and an obsession with Shakespeare.
Right. He collected Shakespeare. He and his wife collected Shakespeareana for 30 years. So this was not someone who had a lot of wealth to throw around and wanted their name on a building. This was a passion and an obsession for both of them. And from the time he was quite young, right after he graduated college, he started collecting things that he could not quite afford, but nonetheless, he started collecting, and then over 30 years, they amassed an absolutely spectacular, unfathomable collection of Shakespeareana and then related things. So once they had really plumbed the depths of what was available in terms of Shakespeare and the sources Shakespeare would have had available to him, they got into musical instruments and theater and Shakespeare performance from the 17th through the 20th centuries and on and on and on. So this the library is their collection, was their family, their passion.
So I guess that, like many people, I've always had the belief, which I guess is pretty much an assumption, that Shakespeare was just popular since day one, that he never ever went out of style, that he was beloved in any country that spoke English and was able to read. But maybe this is not true.
Well, in fact, it's not. He went through times of tremendous popularity. He was quite a popular playwright when he was alive. His plays were being performed regularly, and both Queen Elizabeth and King James sponsored his acting companies and watched the plays at court. But by the time he died, his plays were being performed a little less frequently, and then by the time of he dies in 1616, by the time of the English Civil Wars until the Restoration in 1660, the Puritans have control over the Corporation of London, which would be like the city government, and they would have prohibited the production of plays within the city bounds in London. And then later the Puritans take over Parliament and they do the same thing for all of England, that essentially plays are pretense, and pretending to be something that you are not is a sin against God, and you shouldn't be doing that. So the plays are not performed for a little over a decade. And then when theaters come back into fashion, when Charles II takes the throne back, he is a big theater fan, but now it's been a while since these plays were produced. And then over time, pace did change. Among other things, as we get a little bit later in time, people's sensibilities were slightly different. So you have the excision of the naughty bits of Shakespeare in some plays. There's a man named Bodler who is famous for this sort of cleaning up what was
Two body
in Shakespeare. So, and then, you know, again, taste changed over time, and it was not the case that he was tremendously popular from the time that he started writing until now. He really became the secular god of English language literature over a century and a half.
Isn't that interesting? And so now what made you decide to pursue this particular story?
Well, I had encountered Henry Folger three times. Once in middle school, we used the Folger Library editions of the plays, and I studied Shakespeare both in middle school and high school, then on in college. Second, I encountered Henry Folger again as a named defendant in the 1911 Standard Oil antitrust decision. I'd studied that both in grad school and in law school, and I knew of the case, and I thought, oh, same guy? Is this the same guy who did the Folger editions? And then lastly, when I moved to Washington, D.C. in the mid-1980s, I used to walk by the Folger Library every day on my way to work. So this man kept popping up, and when it came time to write a book, I was given the advice, write about something you already know a little something about and that you know you like because you're going to be living with it for a while. What do you know? What do you like? And I knew that Shakespeare had been my passion since middle school. I'd seen the plays, reread the plays, read a lot of the ancient and historic texts about Shakespeare. But I, you know, there's thousands of books written about Shakespeare. What would I have to add to that? And I decided that sort of weaving these two stories together, one of the Gilded Age in New York and the other of the Elizabethan and Jacobean ages in England, that this would make a great story, and it would inform people as well of things. Even people who love the plays do not know that when Shakespeare died, it was not a slam dunk that he was going to become what he became.
Yeah, and now I'm interested in something you just said. You said when it was time to write a book.
Mm-hmm.
how did you know it was time to write a book, or why was it time to write a book?
My husband is a writer, and I had already helped him with six of his books, sort of helped doing some of the research and doing some of the editing and writing the captions for his illustrations and so on. And he and his agent and I had lunch one day, and both of them said, hey, you could completely do this. You could do this. What would you want to write about? And that was when they gave me the advice, do something you already know a little something about and that you like. So that's sort of how it came about.
That's really neat. And, you know, The Millionaire and the Bard has gotten nothing but great reviews. How are you feeling about having it out there in the world?
It is quite astonishing. It is, for a first-time author to have been reviewed in the New York Times is already extraordinary. And then to be reviewed by Stephen Greenblatt, who has got one of the best-selling books about Shakespeare of the last two decades. Little of the World. He is phenomenal. But then to be reviewed in the Wall Street Journal, in the Chicago Tribune, in the Washington Post, it's just been overwhelming. For a first-time author, it is truly extraordinary, and I've been very humbled and very honored by all of it.
I can imagine. Do you think that the attention let me rephrase that question. Why do you think it's gotten all of that attention?
I don't know. There are certain things that people, it sort of gets into the zeitgeist and people find interesting. And there are a lot of people who like Shakespeare. And I think one of the things that happens is they read the book and they find out things that they didn't know before. And that's always fun for people. You enjoy the story. There's a fast-moving narrative, and part of it is a detective story that chased for these copies of the First Folio. How did he do it? How did he pursue it? And Jeffrey Deaver, who is a thriller writer, told me it's a page-turner. It's written like a detective story. So I think it's a combination of things. One is that it's not a book for eggheads. It's actually, you know, for the popular reader of nonfiction. And the other is that the story is informative and exciting. So I think all of that combined is what people have liked.
And did you get to take a field trip to England as part of your research?
I have not. I've been to England before, but not since I started writing the book. And I'm planning to go next year to do some publicity there. Most of the research that I would have been able to do in England, I could do here. Since the majority of the archive is in one place. So the Folger archive is in the Folger Library in Washington, D.C. There's also material at Amherst College. There's a Rockefeller archive in Westchester County, New York. The Ransom Center in Austin, Texas, at the University of Texas, has the Standard Oil Archive. All of those were useful. There was really not that much that I would have needed to do in England except to absorb the atmosphere, which I plan to do next year.
And there's always a good reason to absorb the atmosphere, right?
Absolutely.
And now I'm curious, are any of Folger's family members alive?
There are some family members alive. They're extremely elderly. They did not have any children, so these would be descendants of his siblings who are still alive. And then on his uncle's side, there also, James Ahern Folger was the founder of Folger's Coffee in San Francisco, and he has some descendants that are still alive. There is a sort of a Folger group up on Nantucket as well.
I'm just curious because I was just wondering if you had any interactions with them and they had any reactions to the book.
I have not had any interactions with them. In part because, you know, I thought about this and I knew where they were, but essentially I'm writing about his collecting, and just about everything about his collecting I can learn from his own words, which are the thousands of letters, memoranda, and scraps of papers, notes that he wrote that are in the Folger archive. So I, for somebody who's in their 80s who might have known him when they were, you know, a young toddler or something, that probably not be that informative in terms of how he would collect. So it's not a biography of Henry Folger, and therefore I really didn't feel compelled to interview them.
Okay, fair enough. That makes a whole lot of sense to me. And Andrea, do you think there's a certain type of reader who will enjoy this especially?
Well, I think there are multiple readers. I'll tell you who's been really responsive to it on the road. One is people who teach Shakespeare, and they love the story of the apotheosis. How did that happen? Who were the people who helped make that happen? What did the first folio mean to saving half of Shakespeare's plays from obscurity? Half of his plays had already been published by the time he died. Half had not. And about 50% is the survival rate of plays of that era, and Shakespeare would have been exactly on target for that. Had this first folio not been published, this book been published by two of his actor friends, fellow shareholders in the Globe Theater, decided to publish this memorial volume after Shakespeare's death, and therefore half of the plays are saved from obscurity. Macbeth, The Tempest, Antony and Cleopatra, Julius Caesar, Two Gentlemen of Verona, and on and on and on. So that's one, is the people who teach and love Shakespeare and the plays. Second are the crazed collectors, and they see themselves, I've met many of them on the road already, they see themselves in Henry Folger. And in part, that for me was informed by the fact that I live with a crazed collector. And so I could understand very well who Henry Folger was and how lucky he was to have a partner who not only shared in his interest in Shakespeare, which she did, but who is on board with and passionate about the collection as well. And then there's the third group who are interested in New York history, the Gilded Age, and the transatlantic trade of culture. And those are sort of the three distinct groups that have really come forward and said they like the book.
And now, are you working on another book?
I'm working on two. One is a book for Scholastic, for young adults, on the pickets charge at Gettysburg. And then separately from that, I'm working on a young adult book based on The Millionaire and the Bard, but essentially to teach high school students about not a biography of Shakespeare, but the apotheosis. How did he go from being one of many talented and popular playwrights of the Jacobean era to obscurity and then back again? And I'm working on a book for young adults in that area.
Oh, I love that. That's so exciting, Andrea.
Thank you.
Well, I just enjoy talking with you so much today. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you so much, Cindy, for having me on your show.
Win a copy of The Millionaire and the Bard by sending a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. Do the same to win a copy of Nuala O'Connor's Miss Emily, a paperback released roughly 2 weeks ago that reimagines the private life of Emily Dickinson through her own voice and through the eyes of her family's Irish maid. As you'll hear during my conversation with Nuala, she and Emily have quite a few things in common, including loving New England. Earlier today, Nuala was in Connecticut at Bank Square Books in Mystic. Tomorrow, she's heading to Massachusetts, where she'll do events at different locations throughout the week. Nuala is from Ireland, so one of the first things I wanted to know is, has she ever been here in New England before?
Yes, when I had finished writing Miss Emily, the first draft, I came over to do research. So that would have been 2 years ago. And then I returned last year to Amherst again for the Emily Dickinson International Society meeting. So I've been twice. This is my third time.
And you're going to be at the Emily Dickinson International Society meeting for 2005 this coming weekend on August 8th.
That's right. I'm reading on Saturday at the conference, which is a great honor, with Susan Snively, who has also written a book about Emily Dickinson. So they've paired us up, and we're presenting a couple of hours of a fictional look into Emily Dickinson's life. So that's at 1:30 on Saturday in the Alumni House at Amherst College.
So I want to hear about this book and about you. You clearly are not someone who grew up in Massachusetts. I think your voice gives that away. Tell us what attracted you to writing a novel about Emily Dickinson, someone so far away in the world from you, and tell us what the story's about.
Yeah, well, we studied Emily's poetry at school, so probably for about 5 years we read her poetry and discussed it, and I did it for my final exams at school. So I absolutely loved her poetry. I love its concision. I love her subject matter, mental health issues and death, and I think it really appeals to teenagers in general. And then I heard later that she loved to bake, and so I started to research her life, discovered she had had Irish maids, and the germ from the novel grew around all of that stuff, around my love of her poetry, the fact that she loved to bake. I love to bake, and I started baking her cakes, her gingerbread, her coconut cake, and then the fact that they had had Irish domestics. So I invented a new Irish maid who comes to to Emily's house. Her name is Ada, in the year 1866, and the two women form a firm friendship. So it's a novel about friendship, and it's also about Irish-American relations, it's about emigration, and it's about class as well.
Well, that is very exciting because, you know, and I love it because there's so much out there about Emily Dickinson, but you've created something totally new and fresh and looked at her life with a different eye altogether.
Yes, I think there's probably a lot of myths that abound about Emily, that she was very downbeat, that she was, you know, so reclusive that she didn't see anybody, these kind of things. Actually, she was a very gregarious woman. She was reclusive, yes, but she had a small circle of people with whom she was extremely friendly. Her sister-in-law, Sue, for example, her immediate family, several other writers and newspaper editors, and her extended family. She wrote beautiful, funny, tender letters. She was quite an intense correspondent. So she only had a small number of friends, but she was quite demanding of them. And I'm sure getting an Emily letter was a treat. I'm sure also sometimes it was a bit cryptic. She wasn't always very, she riddled a lot and she loved in-jokes. She wasn't always very clear when she wrote. I'm sure sometimes people scratched their heads when they read her letters because she loved to be adventurous with prose, and we know this from her poetry. She was very different to the types of writers who were writing contemporary with her. She had her own grammar, her own way of constructing sentences, and she was the same when she wrote letters. They were very eccentric as she was, but beautifully done as well. She was a very funny person, so I kind of wanted to explode the myth about her being this angsty sort of crazy white woman. I wanted woman wearing white, I should say. I wanted to show that she was this funny, friendly woman who loved to bake and who hung around the kitchen and wrote in the kitchen on the backs of chocolate wrappers or whatever came to hand. She was fully involved in the domestic sphere of her own home, you know, where she lived with her parents and her sister.
So the young maid who Emily befriends, or who befriends Emily, or who goes to work for Emily, she is an 18-year-old Irish woman named Ada Concannon.
Yes.
Did I say that right?
Yep.
So tell us about Ada.
Ada is pure fiction. She's an invention. But I decided to make her a cousin of one of the maids who did work for the Dickinsons post-1866, Maggie Marr. She was with them a long time. She was extremely loyal. Vinnie, Emily's sister, depended very heavily on her, especially towards the end. So Maggie and her family had emigrated from County Tipperary. And so I made Ada a cousin of hers, but Ada is from County Dublin. Her mother is from Tipperary. So I'm from County Dublin, and so I made her be from my home place. But while I researched the novel, I went down to Slievna Mon, the beautiful mountain area where Maggie was from, and I explored the area so that I would have that sort of other side of Ada's background to draw on as well. And that was very enjoyable. So I made her new. She's a new person, but she has links to people who actually did know Emily. So in that way, I kind of created a, well, I hope, a quite a rounded fictional person who has a good solid history behind her as well.
And so do we see much of you, Nuala, in Ada?
Maybe. Ada loves to talk, as I do. I think Irish people in general love to talk. And she's a bit superstitious, which I hate admitting to, but I can be slightly superstitious. You know, I salute at magpies and I pick up luck pennies, all that sort of thing. So I researched a lot of older superstitions and I incorporated them into Ada's story. There's a scene where she accidentally puts her shoes on the table, and that's considered terribly bad luck in Ireland. I don't know, maybe it's a worldwide superstition, but it's definitely in Ireland. So I wove that sort of thing in. She's also religious. She's been brought up in a, you know, a deeply Catholic country. Things like she has a St. Bridget's cross over her bed, and the St. Bridget's cross protects from evil. So all this kind of stuff I wove in. Yeah, she's a version of me. I'd say a very distant version. I have written two other novels, and they were much more based on myself.
My mother-in-law is Italian, and she says the same thing about the shoes.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Don't put them on the table. Bad luck.
No, and I find myself always not to, you know, if you're lacing up your child's shoes or something, I always make sure to put them on my lap, not on the table.
And now, you know, we talked a little bit before, or you talked, about the kind of stereotypical Emily Dickinson who is kind of weird and depressed and really isolated. Did you go out of your way to create a different version of Emily?
Yeah, I guess I wanted to shine a light on the real Emily, the one who had this kind of small nation of people that she loved and who she kept close to. There's certainly in later life she did, if visitors came to the house to play piano, for example, to entertain, Emily would listen from behind a door. So there were certain people, maybe brand new people, that she wouldn't see. But if she had had maybe a long correspondence with someone like Thomas Wentworth Higginson, then she would meet that person when they came to the house. It wasn't that she was an out-and-out recluse. She wasn't locked in her bedroom with ink-stained fingers. She was quite involved in the domestic sphere of the home, and she would go across occasionally to the Evergreens, her sister, her brother's house, and her sister-in-law Sue's house. Later in life, she didn't. I know when her nephew died, very sadly, her very young nephew died, she did go across to comfort her brother and his wife. I don't know. You know, there is... She had problems with her eyes. There's a theory that she may have been epileptic. I'm not sure about that. And, you know, she clearly had some sort of agoraphobia or something like that that prevented her from... I mean, she stopped going to church, which was quite a big thing for a Victorian woman to do in New England. You know, that would have been certainly remarked upon. You know, even now, like, say, in Ireland, I think if you live in a small place and you're the only person who doesn't go to church, there's no doubt but that it's noticed. So, you know, it was known that she sequestered herself in her home, but that she had, whatever, her own reasons for doing it.
So, Nuala, tomorrow, Tuesday, August 4th, you are going to be at the Harvard Bookstore. On Wednesday, August 5th, you're going to be at the Odyssey Bookshop in Mount Holyoke. You are going to be, as we said earlier, on Saturday at the Amherst Alumni House for the Emily Dickinson International Society meeting. Is there something that you are hoping that people are going to come up to you and say that they learned or realized or experienced from reading Miss Emily?
I'd hope that they... Well, I would hope that the book would send them back to Emily's poetry. You know, she wrote close to 1,800 poems, and maybe we read a dozen of those at school as school children, and maybe since then we've neglected her or haven't realized that she had such an extent, such a huge repertoire of work. So what I would love is if people come up and said, you know, after I read your book, I realized this was a flesh and blood, funny, articulate, nice, kind woman, and I went back and read her poetry, and I found new things. I mean, I'm reading her poetry again over the last 3 years in the course of writing and researching this book, and every time I pick up her collected poems, I seem to find something new. She has her poems are often wonderfully aphoristic, and so we can find really helpful gems of truth in them that might help us in our lives. And I think that's what's beautiful about her poetry. She was very astute on human nature and on how we view things, and she can help, you know, Emily can help. So maybe if somebody finds that Emily has helped them, well, that would be great.
I love that. Nuala, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thanks a lot, Cindy. Lovely to talk to you.
Julia Pierpont is the author of Among the 10,000 Things, a novel rolling to the top of must-read lists that starts with a letter from a man's former lover. It's one out of many letters and emails in a box that was mailed to the man's wife. But instead of the wife receiving it, it winds up in her children's hands. Among the 10,000 Things has been available in bookstores for a couple of weeks now, but as I told Julia, I feel like I've been hearing about this book and just how wonderful it is and how I must read it for many, many months.
It has been sort of a long process, and it's amazing to have, you know, something you started. This is the longest I've ever worked on any single thing. And it's been... I think the first time it actually felt like it was really coming out into the world was at the book launch, and I saw, you know, my friends and family there and everything, and it just felt like, oh, this is what I've been waiting for this whole time. This is the thing I told you guys I was working on for so long. I really was, you know, here it is. I don't know. I mean, in a certain way, you're not really privy to a lot of what other people know about the book, I think, and certainly still surprising to me when somebody, you know, tells me that they've read it or something, but, you know, it's been amazing, too.
So now you mentioned a couple times how long it took you to write it. How long did it take you to complete this book?
Probably not terribly long in relation to, you know, how long books take. I started the book in 2010, and then there was sort of a long editing process as well. So I would say it was about, I think I started working with my editor at Random House, Noah Eaker, around the end of 2012 to the start of 2013.
So tell us what the plot is all about.
Right. So this is a story about a family, specifically an artist in New York, Jack, and his wife and two kids who are 11 and 15. And basically a package arrives one day from Jack's earned mistress, detailing a lot about their affair, and it's addressed to his wife, Deb, but it lands in the hands of the children. And basically the story, the action of the novel is composed of the fallout from that.
So I'm going to tell you one of my ridiculous secrets, and that is that someday someone is going to send me a live snake in a box.
Oh, God.
And then when I open the box, you know, it's good. The snake is going to clearly come out and mm-hmm. bite me.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say, I mean, this is a snake in a box.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah.
So where did the story idea come from?
You know, I didn't really even set out so much to write. I've realized now from just talking to people and everything that it's sort of an unorthodox subject, especially for someone in my stage of life. I've never been married, and, you know, I've never had to deal with that kind of situation. But I really didn't even set out to write about infidelity so much as I set out to write about the way that families can fall apart and the way that they can misinterpret each other, like the best intentions can wind up causing harm. And also the way that what happens when what we teach our children turns out, when our children realize that what they've been taught this whole time is not necessarily the way that adults actually live, that relationships are a lot more complicated than that. The idea, infidelity and adultery were really the lens through which I ended up exploring these ideas of betrayal and dysfunction within a family.
So if you had to, you know, pinpoint who this story is about, is it the story of a couple? Is it the story of the children of the couple?
Mm-hmm. I tried very hard to keep it a story for each one of them. Part of one of the things that books do so well and that I was really excited, I knew I wanted to do from the outset, was write from different perspectives, especially, you know, when you get to describe a single incident and, you know, there are three truths to every story, so you get to show how one person had one kind of impression out of something that someone said and the other person had an entirely different intention. So for me, writing it, I have a lot of feelings for each of the characters. I think maybe it is a story for all of them, I think.
So this is your first novel, correct?
Yes, correct.
That was pretty ambitious of you to decide that you were going to write it from more than one point of view.
I know, yeah, I realized that as I was working on it. I thought, maybe for the next one, just one. That'll be enough.
Well, I'm interested in learning, what does that say about you? You know, are you this overly ambitious type of person? And if you're going to do something, you're just going to do it, you know, the biggest, grandest, sparkliest way possible, you know, rather than ease your way in?
Oh, you know, no, I don't think so. I think probably a lot of it had to do with just the books that I love and the way that they dip into different characters' minds. I don't think you can really write a book thinking about what impression it's going to have or how it's going to be received. You know, for most of the time that you're writing it, it didn't even occur to me, I think, when I first started that it would be the book I ended up writing, because you never know. You think maybe you'll have false starts and end up scrapping whatever you did and have to start again. But it was just sort of, I just sort of followed the story and followed where my interests lie and that they happened to be there.
One of the countless great, great reviews you received that I thought was really interesting was from the Huffington Post, which compared you to Virginia Woolf and your insight into human consciousness. I mean, that's just awesome.
Yeah, that's crazy. that's an amazing thing for them to write.
The reviews are just fabulous, Julia.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been really, really wonderful to see people respond to the book.
Is it all very surreal, though?
It is. You know, it is surreal. It's sort of stayed that way. It was from the get-go, and it hasn't gotten any less so. And, you know, even though it's not an autobiographical story, really, there are so many things, parts of myself in it, or observations or feelings that I've had, and to have people read it and respond to it, it feels very intimate, actually, and very rewarding in that way.
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about that, and I'm curious, where do we see you in this novel?
Well, I mean, the only character I would say I've been biographically, I've been a young girl before, so I guess Kay would be the daughter of the family, would be my closest, counterpart in the book. But that's not to say that I don't feel, I can feel myself and the other characters. And it's certainly not to say that she was the easiest to write, because I think there's some danger, or at least I felt some danger, writing a character that I had been in the past, or whose position I'd been in, as a young girl and everything, to not just write myself, or not write how I would react to a certain situation, to keep it within a character.
So is this novel strictly to entertain, or is it meant to do something else?
I don't know how much, again, because I didn't necessarily know it was going to be the books that anybody read. I don't know what my intentions were going into it, of how it would be received. But I know that, I think that there was a lot about just, connecting and it's certainly not just to entertain. I wouldn't say that. There are a lot of more serious themes in the book that I wanted to explore that have been sort of very rewarding for me, too, just to figure out how I feel about or think about the world, too.
So you've mentioned a couple of times about how, you know, you embarked on this with the understanding that you could have a couple of false starts, that mm-hmm. maybe no one is ever going to read what you write. It may never even turn into a book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that sounds awfully, I don't know, noble is not the right word, but just that you were willing to write for writing's sake. And I don't know if...
Mm-hmm.
I don't know many writers who would be willing to do that.
Well, I mean, I think it happens more than people realize, though, maybe. I mean, it certainly is not what you set out to, what you hope to have happen. But, I was in grad school at the time, and that was kind of a gift because I had this time set aside to work on this. And up until that point, you know, I spent a couple years after college temping and bartending and doing things, and writing stories was sort of what I did for I wouldn't say for fun, but it was this form of expression that it was what I ended up going home and doing basically in my spare time. It was what I felt compelled to do. And then when I realized that there are such things as writing programs where you can go and basically have a couple year long retreat, and that just seemed like a perfect thing, opportunity for me to try to get something done and to give it kind of the attention that I'd wanted to give it. You certainly don't hope, you hope that it'll work out, but you have to understand that it could not. And I think it would be worse to cling to something that wasn't working, ultimately.
So now I'm guessing that you're writing full time now and you're not bartending.
I'm not bartending. I do work, a day job. I copy edit. So I do have a job, but I am writing a lot more now than I was then.
And are you working on your next novel?
I have been working a little bit on what might be my next novel. I'm not sure if it will turn out to be something I end up staying with. But it's been hard to balance sort of the watching this book come out into the world with the idea of coming up with something new, and also a little bit sad to move on in a strange way from the characters and sort of start with new ones. But I'm also pretty excited to start something new.
Yeah, and I think that people are pretty excited to have you write something new, though, gosh, there must be at least a little bit of pressure to come up with something that's going to be as well received as this first novel, or do you not even think about that?
Well, I mean, I think it's incredibly exciting to think that this is the first time I'll be writing anything that I might expect someone would read, as opposed to assume no one will. So that is just kind of very invigorating, actually, I think, more than scary. Just to, you know, sometimes when you're writing, you have the sense that you're just playing house. You know, you're playing with a dollhouse, moving the parts around, and it's just for yourself, and that's its own kind of interesting experience. But the idea that it could make its way out into the world is an entirely different feeling.
Yes, and now you have a website where people can go and learn more about you
mm-hmm.
and the book and where you're going to be. Can you tell us what that is?
Yes, it is just Julia Pierpont, my name, at, .com. There's no at. Yeah, so juliapierpont.com.
And you're on Facebook and Twitter, right?
Yes, I am. Yeah, at Julia Pierpont is my Twitter. And then it's have an author page on Facebook, too. Yeah.
And do you enjoy hearing from fans?
Oh, it's great. Yeah, I love it. And I also love posting things and pictures of my dog and stuff. So it's sort of a fun side feature that I get to do now. That sort of, I guess, that hasn't been around that long for writers.
Yeah, and it's fun for the readers as well to have that interaction because it makes it so much more intimate, I think, and brings the experience alive.
Yeah, and you don't get to hear that much otherwise from readers. I mean, I guess at readings, you know, someone comes up to you afterwards, but otherwise it's very rare to hear from someone who just responded to a certain part of the book, and that's so gratifying and lovely, and it's such a nice feature that I'm grateful to have, yeah.
Julie, we need to wrap things up, but is there something that you would like people to know about the book or the process or why they should read it or what they're going to expect or what they're going to find there?
You know, I wish I had a good answer for that. I really think that it has to stand on its own. So I won't, you know, preface it with anything. I just hope that people enjoy it or find something good in it.
Julia, thank you so much for talking with
thank
me.
Thank you.
Win a copy of Among the 10,000 Things by sending a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. If you haven't yet tried to win a copy of Miss Emily or The Millionaire and the Bard, it's not too late. Again, the contact information for you to win one of these books or any of the books tonight is LitNewEngland on Twitter or LitNewEngland@gmail.com. While you're doing that, I want to thank my terrific guests tonight. So thank you, Andrea Mays, Julia Pierpont, and Nuala O'Connor. If you missed any part of tonight's show, in just a few minutes, the entire episode will be available in the Literary New England Radio Show archives. In fact, all of our past episodes are there, dating back to our very first episode in December 2011. I'd like to offer you the same thing that I offered our listeners a couple of weeks ago, and that is if sometime in the next day or so you go back to that very first episode in December 2011 and you tweet @LitNewEngland with one of the names of the guests on that very first show, I might pick your name and you might win a box of books containing some of those by the authors who have been on the show since that time. I'm looking at my bookshelf right now and I have some awesome titles and I would love to put together a box of 4 or 5 books for you. So I hope to hear from you. The Literary New England Radio Show will be back next week with more great author interviews and book giveaways. I hope you'll be with us too. Until then, have a great week and great reading.